Everyone's on, right? Always good to start the day on a merit. Like I always do, please do all things you do mindfully, knowing the purpose behind why you do it. Because if your phone vibrates, which is perfectly fine, keep it on vibrate mode. You don't have to put it on silent, because you might be expecting an important call. So keep it on vibrate mode, and then if it's in your pocket or if it's in your hand, then you know that your phone's going off, right? So what you can do is just very politely leave the room, take your call, and you can come back and sit down and listen to the sermon. But what happens if it goes off and it makes a sound? Then everyone has to know that you're needed. And then it interrupts the sermon, right? So then, not only is your attention interrupted, but also unnecessarily that of others as well. So when you put your phone on vibrate mode, only your interruption is at end. Only your attention is interrupted, but you have to take the call anyway. So you go out, you take your call and come back and you continue. So then when you put your phone on vibrate, or rather when you silence your phone, you're doing it for whom? For others. That's why I say, do it mindfully and you can get some benefit out of doing it. You can earn some merits out of it. So it's not just a case of doing it out of courtesy, which is always, of course, something that we must do it out of courtesy, not just in this sermon, wherever you are. If you're in a lecture, if you're in a seminar, in some meeting, and you are expecting a private call, then it's always good to have your phone on vibrate mode or keep it on silent. So it's just a matter of courtesy. But especially in a sermon, it's always good, because otherwise it interrupts people's attention. And sometimes it could make the difference between an individual leaving this room as a Prithakjana or a Sotapanna. So why deprive someone of a sansara, once in a sansara time opportunity to free themselves from the four great hells? It's a far greater loss than perhaps even stealing a child from its mother, because you'll get a mother again. You'll find a mother again, but will you find a Buddha again? Or a noble friend again? These are very rare chances. That is why we do this very carefully, mindfully, and you earn merits when you do so. So the other thing is your bottles. When you feel a bit lazy or tired, you start playing football with your bottles, especially if they're metallic ones. Doesn't happen so much here, but at the monastery it's a very common occurrence. So if you have a metallic bottle, particularly, on one occasion at the monastery we ask people to put them into cases, cloth cases, so that even if it does fall, it doesn't make so much of a noise, because it's tiled there. But even while you're here, if you have a metallic bottle or something that falls and makes a noise, maybe just put it slightly to a side, so that when you stretch your legs, it doesn't make a noise. Best is to put it in front of the legs of the person behind you, so that when they stretch their legs, you can go shh. You can vent your frustration on them. Shall we begin? Excellent. Okay, let's bring our palms together then, to make our utmost veneration with respect and regard to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. Let us remind ourselves that as we do this, this is not just a mere ritual or a mark of our obeisance. This is our pledge of allegiance to the ultimate bliss of Nibbana, to the Dhamma that gets us there, and the practice that we must all undertake individually that helps us to get to our destination. This is what the Buddha Dhamma and the Sangha represents. Once we've done that, let us observe the five precepts, which will remind us to remain mindful throughout our conduct here, as well as when we are back in our day-to-day lives. Let us also then invite the countless sentient beings in the 10,000 world systems and within earshot of this sermon. May they be amongst us and witness this wonderful gathering of disciples of the Buddha as they make an effort to embark on a journey of liberation. If they are lacking in merits, may they rejoice in these merits, and may such merits help them to be born in the blissful plane. And for all sentient beings in the blissful plane, including yourselves, may this be an opportunity to listen to the teachings of the Great Master and free yourselves once and for all from suffering. So with all that in mind, let us make a start to today's proceedings. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Usually in these talks we take a few minutes at the beginning to remind for ourselves why we do what we do. That is a string that weaves all these beads together, keeps all these beads together. If the Dhamma is the bead, if the sermons that you come here and the Dhamma that you learn, these are the beads. Beads alone cannot make a necklace. You need the string with which you tie all these beads together, right? That is the purpose. It's when you have purpose, those beads arrange in a certain way and actually become something meaningful. Otherwise, they're just beads strewn across a table or a surface. So the most beautiful beads cannot add beauty to you unless they are tied together, woven together, hung together, strung together with a piece of string. And that is the purpose. Why the Dhamma? So important, ladies and gentlemen. When Guru Swami Nuhansi speaks to us at the monastery on Thursdays, he spends much more time talking about our practice, the purpose behind what we do, to reinvigorate us, to remind us why we have chosen this noble life. What is the purpose of being a monk? The purpose of the Anagarika livelihood, the Anagarika livelihood. Why we have come together, why it is our devotees go many extra miles to support this mission. And then he spends about half an hour talking about the Dhamma, of about a 4-hour sermon. And he says, if you want more Dhamma, listen to the Saturday sermon. That's what he tells us. You wouldn't believe it, that's what he tells us. He says, if you want the Dhamma, listen to the Saturday sermon. If you want to do Nibbana, listen to the Thursday sermon. So the Saturday sermon is like a prescription. It's where you meet the doctor. The Thursday sermon is where you see the nurse. The doctor gives you the drugs. He says, this is what's wrong with you, take the drugs. Prescribes. And on Thursday, that's nursing. Nursing to good health. Nursing till recovery. And the same happens whenever there are programs. We have the Sila Shravaka program, Shravika, Uesi. In these programs, there are lots of nurses, a lot of nursing happens there. You understand what I mean by this? Yeah? So, a bit of Dhamma and a lot of practice. And the support mechanism that needs to be there. So the purpose behind what we do is as important as the Dhamma itself. The other day we had some visitors from a very popular school in Colombo. And they had a tour of the monastery. And then I asked the senior management that had got together and they wanted to speak a few words with us. I asked them this question. I asked them, your teachers, vice principals, section heads, heads of the organization, if I told you that the children that you're going to teach and you put your life and soul into teaching them, educating them, if I told you that soon after they graduate from school, they're going to have to spend the rest of their lives in prison, the remainder of their lives in prison, a life sentence, would you do what you're doing with the same enthusiasm? This is the question I asked the teachers. What do you think the answer was? Of course not. Because if you knew that there would be no result in what you're doing, this is not productive, then you wouldn't do it. You would do it just because it was something that had to be done, right? As a sense of duty, maybe an obligation, but you wouldn't be able to apply yourself, exert yourself and do it with passion, because you know that there isn't going to be a product at the end of it. So I said, this is why we must work together. I was making a proposal to them. They're a very good school and they do really well in terms of educating children. But I said, you're educating the youth of this nation, and inevitably they're going to end up in prison. And they said, no, how can you say that, Swami? So many of our students go on to become very successful in life. Hardly any end up in prison, and even if they do, it's for a very short time, not life sentences. I said, yes, I agree. But I said, I speak in metaphors. This is not the real prison I'm talking about. I'm talking about the prison, doors that open soon after they're dead. Do you just want to teach them for a lifetime? Or do you want to ensure that the time, effort and energy that you put into developing these young people, these young individuals, can serve for many lifetimes? How about that, if you had that as an opportunity? If you could be guaranteed that these children that you teach today will not end up in the four great hells, what do you think about that, is what I asked them. You know what ends up someone in the four great hells, don't you? What is it? Sins. Unmeritorious deeds. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct or sensual misconduct, lying. These are some of them. These are the more common ones among them. But then there are others at the tail end of the 10 unmeritorious deeds which don't get talked about very often, but they are there nonetheless because they don't require physical action. It's all in the mind. Hate is one of the sins that can end up an individual in the four great hells. Miccha ditti, the last one of the 10, doesn't get talked about at all. What is miccha ditti? Wrong view. You know it as a phrase, wrong view. But generally speaking, people don't spend a lot of time trying to understand what does this wrong view actually mean? What does it mean, wrong view? Today is Sunday, so if someone thinks today is Monday, is that wrong view? Well, that's also a wrong view. Certainly, I'm not going to suggest that that's the right view. But that's not going to end you up in hell. But the Buddha explains to us a number of things which if remain with you towards the end of your life and you do not come out of them, then he says, someone who dies with wrong views is to be born in the four great hells. I will give you a few of them, just for you to think about. Natti mata, natti pita. That there is no special person called a mother or a father. That they're not special or unique in any way. That they're just ordinary human beings, just like my uncle, my aunt, or my neighbors. The ways in which you treat them, you can treat your parents, and you know there's not going to be any special repercussions or consequences if you deal with them in a bad way, if you treat them badly. This is natti mata, natti pita. It's not that there is no such thing as a biological mother or father. Everyone knows that there's a biological mother or father. That's not what the Buddha speaks of. To think that the mother and the father are just mere ordinary human beings, just like anyone else. That. To not treat your parents with due respect, due regard. So I ask you a question. At a school, you teach children physics, chemistry, science, math, sociology, economics, and various other subjects. In which subject do they teach you that the mother and the father are very special and unique individuals? Is it physics? Chemistry? Biology? Biology, yes. No, I don't speak about the biological connection you have with your parents. That's not what I talk about. That's not what the Buddha speaks of. Anyone knows that. A puppy knows its mother. That's the biological connection. You don't have to be human for that. So in which subject do they teach you that? Or maybe it's not at school level. You have to get to university to learn that, right? Yeah? Did I get that right? Or maybe not at undergraduate, it's a postgraduate level. That you learn that the mother and father are very special, unique individuals. They are matchless, peerless. So I ask these teachers, have you never heard complaints, had never had complaints from these children's parents of how the child mistreats the parents? How when they're angry, they raise their arms, strike them, hit them, yell at them, scream at them, use foul language with them? Have you never had such complaints? I ask these teachers. And they're looking at me and going, are you watching the camera, Swami Master? How do you know all this? How do you know all this? I said, well, you know, when you fail to fix them, they come to us. When you fail to fix them, they come to us. The parents bring them to us. First the parent comes and weeps at our feet. Oh, the number of mothers and fathers whose tears I have seen. When they come and get down on their knees and all they ask for is, Swami Nasa, please help me. Please save my child. I don't know where it is I went wrong. I have no idea where it is we went wrong, because we did everything in our power. We gave them the best of opportunities. We fed them well. We educated them. They go to the best schools in the country. We provided for them. We've planned the next 20 years for them. We sacrificed. There's no sacrifice we left undone. Everything was done. But Swami Nasa, why do our children treat us like this? This is a question we get to hear. You'll be surprised, ladies and gentlemen, how often we get these laments and weeps. Many mothers come and shed tears at the monastery. We are like agony aunts, the mothers and fathers. I have seen far too many fathers with tears in their eyes. Typically, a father is not a character who cries, right? At least in our culture, fathers don't cry. They have to hold themselves strong. They must not show any sign of weakness. This is our culture. But at the monastery, different story. When they feel like they're not going to be judged anymore, when they feel that they're in a safe haven, when they feel that the Swaminarayanas are the ultimate individuals who are going to save us once and for all, then they break open. They start with a few words, "Swaminarayanas, I've got a problem." "What is it, sir?" "Please." "Swaminarayanas, please don't call me sir." "Why, sir?" "I don't deserve to be called sir." "Swaminarayanas, I have failed." They say, "I'm a director of this company, of a certain company. I'm a chairman of that company. I'm a banker. Sir, I'm a doctor. Venerable sir, I'm a physician, I'm a teacher, I'm a scientist, etc., etc., etc. But I don't know where I went wrong. We brought three beautiful children into this world." These are the confessions of a father. "Three beautiful children into this world. My wife went through a lot bringing them into this world. I was there when she delivered them one at a time. I held her hand. I was there, Swaminarayanas. They were the apples of our eyes. We would never let them out of our sight. As a father, I did everything I could. By the time I had my second, I went out to work extra hours because I wanted to provide for my family. By the time I had my third, Swaminarayanas, I was working 7 days at a stretch because that is what I was supposed to do as a father. Where did I go wrong, Swaminarayanas?" asks the father. So I ask, "What's the problem, sir?" "Swaminarayanas, I don't know where to begin." At this point, the mother looks down. She's embarrassed. The father says, "Swaminarayanas, by this point we've come to a place where people look at my wife and they curse her. They curse her for bringing children like this into this world. The mother starts to cry. She can't contain herself anymore. I mean, which mother can? When people you know walk up to you, point at you and say, "What kind of a mother are you to bring these," and they use some words, "into this world? This world was better without them. You shouldn't have brought these children to this world. You are a witch," she's been called. A mother, to be called a witch. So what does the mother do? She tries to take solace with the father, with her husband. And what can the father do? At the beginning, they try to admonish the children, use force, punishment, but soon, you know how successful punishment is as a corrective mechanism. When they're very young, you can do that, but no sooner than they start growing up, and now the children are taller than the father, then what do? They're muscular. They're strong. They're stronger than the father. Then what do? And then the father says, "Swaminarayanas, Can you see those marks on my wife's face? That wasn't me, Swami Mahasa. That was the elder son. The mother gets beaten regularly. But very educated children. Been to very good schools, private schools, not the regular government ones. Private schools. Very educated. But the mother gets beaten. So I said, why? Why does the mother get beaten? Well, because we have some land. And we are trying to be fair by the three children. But they won't see eye to eye. These are children that shared the same womb, Swami Nas, and I can't believe that. I'm beginning to wonder whether that was just my imagination. How can three children who shared the same womb, who came from the same mother and father, behave like this? He points at scars on the mother's head. Swami knows that this was left in one of the beatings. Evidence. I said, what did you do? Did you go to the police? I didn't have any other questions to ask at this point, because they had to do something to save themselves. How can we, Swami Nansa? How can we wash our dirty linen in public? Very true. What will the neighbors think of us? What will our relations think of us? Some of our distant relations, when our children were younger, they warned us. They said, what you're doing is wrong. This is not how you should be bringing these children up. You have to have a little bit more discipline at home. But we never listened, because we thought we loved our children. So we gave them everything they wanted. No sooner than they'd ask for it, I would go and work extra hours if I had to, do weekends, do overtime if I had to, and I would bring it to them. And I would give it to them, and they would have it. That's how much I loved them, Swami Nansa. Or at least I thought that was how I should love them. What about the second child, I ask? Swami Nansa, still very well educated. We sent him to Australia. His further studies. Soon after, we got to know that he'd started doing drugs. So I asked him, had you not taught him to be careful? Well, we didn't have time for that, Swami Nansa. We thought that the schools would teach them that. We didn't have time for that. Have you never taken him to a temple or church anywhere? what temple, Swami Nansa? We have no time for that, Swami Nansa. Has he ever been introduced to a monk? He doesn't like monks. Because he says monks always say, don't do this, don't do that, don't drink, don't have fun. So he doesn't like monks. He says they are joy killers, not monks. So he doesn't like them. So I said, so then any chance you might be able to bring them to me? Are you kidding me? He asks me. If that were possible, Swami Nansa, they'd be here with us right now. But it's just you, my wife and I. We are the only two people who have realized that we failed. We are not a failure, Swami Nansa, we are a disaster. A father's words, I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, a father's words. This man's in tears at this point, sobbing. Have you ever heard a father sob? I really hope you never do. It's very painful to watch. Mothers, I mean, they do it once a week, right? It's what mothers do. They sob, they cry, they sob. You're not a mother, at least. Not until you've at least sobbed once or twice. Fathers, because they have an impression to make, they have a reputation to keep. So it's very difficult to get a teardrop out of a father's eyes. So they don't well up easily. But when they do, it's earth-shattering. That's how I would put it. When a father sobs, it's earth-shattering. The children don't realize that this is a curse that they have brought upon themselves. When a mother and a father complain, moan, weep, lament, and break down in front of a stranger, crying their eyes out about their children, I can't think of a bigger curse than that on those children. Because when parents cry like that about their children, ladies and gentlemen, the whole universe feels that. The whole universe feels that. I really hope no one finds themselves in that situation. Certainly, I really don't hope your children find themselves in that situation. Where you have to end up doing that because of them. Better dead, I say. Better dead than to live a life where your parents have to be like that in front of a stranger because of you. At least when you're dead, you don't attract a curse. Seriously. So what about the third child, I ask? She was my beloved, she's my beloved daughter, the father says. I have never loved anyone as I loved her, Swaminathan said. Never. If there was anyone I loved as much, it would only be my wife and my mother before her. But never have I ever loved anyone as much as I love my daughter. But she broke my heart, Swaminathan. She broke my heart. She tore my heart out, he says. Why? What happened? She brought utter disgrace on our family. I protected her. I was always there. Never would I let a stranger cross paths with her. I was always there by her side, protecting her, guarding her, keeping her safe from anything and everything. I was fierce when there were others around her. Like a lioness would protect her cubs, I was like that, Swaminathan, with her. But then, she wanted other things. She didn't care for her father. When she came of age, she started having interest. I said, in a boy? No, Swaminathan, in boys. I said, boys? Boys, Swaminathan. So is she with someone? No, Swaminathan, she is with them. Who's them? Lots, Swaminathan. Lots. She's now like an object that's at an auction. She gets auctioned. 1 week she's with one man, the next week she's with another. I said, what do you do to have you try to contact her? What, I mean, she's in touch. Well, we sent her abroad as well for her education. That's what we did, for education. They always do it for what? Education. Who's the one who gets educated? When you send your children for education, who gets educated? Huh? Say it out loud. Who? The parents, yes. The parents get a really good education. So it's true, you send them for education. Your education. Because you don't go with them, right? You just send them. And you think one phone call a week will do. They'll tell you what you want to hear. Don't think that what they tell you is the truth and nothing but the truth. They haven't sworn to tell you the truth. This father had. That's the thing. He says, Swaminarayan says, you know what? When I first got to know that something was going on, something funny, something fishy was going on, I brought her down. She was young at the time, so she was still obedient to me. So I brought her down. And then I sat her down and asked her whether things were okay, and I'm hearing things on the grapevine. Is that true? Are they true? And she said, she said no. She denied everything. And I said, my dear daughter, I'm your father. Tell me, whatever it is, tell me, and I will be here to protect you. You know that I have always been protective of you. Not once did she say anything that was going on, Swaminarayan? And I asked her, do you swear that what you're saying is true and no funny business? Would you believe me, Swaminarayan? At this point, she touched my head. She placed her hand on my head and she said, yes, Tati, no funny business. Only later on did I get to know Swaminarayan that her mates had advised her what to do when the father talks to her. They told her beforehand that if your father starts asking too many questions, then your father, being the traditional, conventional man that he is, just put your hand on his head and promise him that everything's fine. No, the moment you do that, he will believe everything from there on. Only later did I learn that. So my child had been taught how to lie with her beloved father. And I sent her to be educated, Swaminarayan. She got a good education. So now she's well known in that part of the country. Well known. Unmarried and well known is a problem. Don't you think, ladies? If you're unmarried yet well known, problem, isn't it? Yeah, that's what the father said. She's unmarried, but she's well known. So I said, any serious relationship? Are they thinking of settling down? No, nobody wants her now, Swaminarayan said. I tried to speak to some of the boys and I said, like, no, puta. I, in fact, he says, I had a very hearty conversation with them to try and see whether they were husband material. And they were laughing at me in my face. They asked me a question, Swaminarayan said, permit me to ask this question of you, or to repeat what one of the boys asked me. You permit me to share that with you now, will you? The father says, one of the boys had asked her, uncle, would you marry someone who's been around the block? Would you marry a girl who's been around the block with every Tom, Dick and Harry? Let me be honest with you, uncle. I used her. Swaminas, I could have punched him in his face, but I kept my composure because I realized that there was no point in doing that. What was broken was already broken. I couldn't repair what was broken anymore. So what would be the point in attacking in one of the people who had broken it? What was precious to me was broken. What was dear to me was broken. It was shattered, never to be repaired again. See, just imagine that as a father. There are fathers in this room. Fathers of daughters, put your hand up for me. Fathers of daughters, thank you. I have 180. Fathers, I ask you, if a man sits in front of you, looks at you in the eye and says, uncle, your daughter, she's been around the block. We use her. You want me to marry her? You think my parents would approve of that? For a man to ask that from you? A man who's already been with your daughter? How would you contain the emotions that would surge in your heart? I mean, if you were a bomb, you would blow at that point, wouldn't you? You'd blast at that point. That is how the father felt at the time. But by that point, it was too late, ladies and gentlemen. But wasn't the daughter educated? Highly educated. Not in Sri Lanka, abroad. Where we send our children to be? Very well educated, abroad. So the father and the mother, now they end up with three children. One hits the parents. Whenever he's annoyed, that's what he does. So there are, he says, the father says, the mother is speechless. She just can't open up. She can't get a word out of her mouth. She can't speak. All she was doing throughout that session was just crying her eyes out. That's all she was doing. She was sobbing and crying. At one point, you know, I couldn't even watch her. It was getting too much. And I said, madam, do you want to step aside maybe? Or shall we leave the room? Even to that, she couldn't reply. Because she realized her life had become a disaster. She was a ruin, that's it. People cursing her for having given birth to children like that. Just think about that, ladies and gentlemen. You know, mothers in the room, I ask you, if anyone would come up to you and curse you for having born the children that you had, how would you feel as a mother? And call you a witch. Think about it. You are a mother. You know how a mother feels, right? So I ask you, mothers, you know, you can resonate with a mother who must be going through this turmoil. Would you like your wives to be called a witch? Husbands? Fathers? For having born your child? And brought him and brought her into this world? Because they just didn't have the time for any Dhamma. Too busy. Too busy to learn what it meant to be human. They learned humanities at university. But they never learned what it meant to be human. They learned physics, science, math. Very educated. But they don't know what it means to be human. Natti mata, natti pita. If someone ever understands what it means, what a mother is, who a mother is, ladies and gentlemen, to raise an arm, you would not even dream of it. Trust me. If someone understands who a mother is, if someone really understands who their father is, how unique and how very special that particular human being is to you, not even in your wildest dreams would you raise an arm, a hand, to strike her or him. But in this particular family, oh, that's just very commonplace. Why? Natti mata, natti pita. Mother is not special, father is not special. They're just average human beings. They brought us into this world, so what must they do now? Feed us, teach us, give us shelter, give us money, buy us the things that we need, educate us. This is not your family, okay? Not your children. Someone else's. Therefore, you need not worry. Nothing for you to worry. Just saying, this is some other family, some other children, not your children. The truth is this. It's not anybody's children. It's children to whom the Dhamma was never given. That's it. Let's put it like that. If there is a child to whom the Dhamma is not given as a gift, if the Dhamma is not taught, the Dhamma is nothing but the truth. If the truth is not taught, ladies and gentlemen, then this is the result. The siblings can't get along with each other because they're fighting over land. They're prepared to hit their mother in exchange for a piece of land. They have forgotten the first land that they were in, haven't they? Where was the first plot of land we were all in? In the mother's womb. That was the first plot of land that we were all in. How much rent did you pay? How much rent? Free. But these children, they had forgotten that. They were prepared to punch the mother. They were prepared to strike the mother. This father says, sometimes I'm in my office doing whatever my work, because I have to bring work. At one point I decided to bring my work home because it's just getting too much work to finish, because I had to provide for my family and my children. When the education bill started going off the roof, I had to work extra hard, and then I didn't just do my work at home, at work. I brought my work home, so I had an office done. Some days while I'm doing my works, while I'm doing my work, doing my meetings, I would hear screams from the house, from the kitchen, from the bedroom. And then I would quickly excuse myself and get up and run to realize that this, my elder son, pulling at his mother's hair, she was screaming, "Please let me go. I will give you whatever you want, please let me be." This is a mother's cry to the child, to her firstborn. So I asked him, "What did you do to solve the problem, to stop this situation?" Swaminathan said, "I'd never hit my children. So I never could bring myself to hit my son. I'd never done that. Because that is how I brought my children up. I'd never put an arm or a hand on them. Never hit them. So I'd never done that before. I could never do it in this time. So the best I could do was simply beg, until at one point I just got on my knees and begged my son to let go of my wife. So I'm a disaster. Just imagine that. The firstborn tugging at the mother's hair while she screams in pain, "Give me my property, give me my land." And the mother saying, "Yes, I will. I will share it fairly among all of you." But this boy saying, "No, I want the bigger part. I want it all for myself." The father can do nothing at all but get down on his knees and beg from his son. The only time a father must get down on his knees in front of a son is the day that he wears this, ladies and gentlemen. No other time. That's the only time. Unless your son is in robes, there should never be a time where a father must get on his knees in front of his son. Don't you agree with me? But here's a father on his knees, begging not for salvation, as a father would from his ordained son, not for salvation, but for mercy. "Please let go of my wife." Because at that point he would not see the mother as a mother. So there was no point in saying, "Please let go of your mother." He was not a mother. She was not his mother. She was just a wicked witch who was not letting him have the land, the property that he wanted. He says, "Swaminas, I have never used any foul language with my wife. That's how much I love my wife. Never have I ever used any foul language. I have never shouted at her, screamed at her. But soon after my child's 18th birthday, the word for the female dog, that was commonplace at home. You know the word. Para. You know the one, right? That one. So yeah, the parents got a good education. Well, what you give is what you get, isn't it? They gave a good education to the children and they got a good education out of it. They never gave the children the Dhamma. They'd never given them peace, never given them compassion, never taught them how to love. Therefore, they've never got that back from their children. What can you do now, ladies and gentlemen, when it's your children? Go to the police? That's a joke. How can you go to the police? And when the neighbors would come and ask why the mother was screaming, "Oh, I just had a stomachache." I mean, what can you say? That's what the mother had always said. So they made up a story that the mother was fighting with cancer or something, and she had these griping pains, and so once in a while she would scream. That was the story that they told the neighbors. See? But the funny thing is, those pains only came when the elder son was at home. When he was out of the country, away from home, no pains. Funny, no one worked that out. Well, at least they did, but no one spoke a word. This is not some script from a drama. Okay? This is not some script from a teledrama. This is real life. This happens in society. This is out there, wherever you are. This happens next door. I just hope your next dose don't agree with the same. I hope your next dose don't say, yes Swaminathan, it happens next door. You get what I mean? Yeah. So where did he go wrong? This is the question he has for me. That's all he'd come to ask me. Because I asked him, can you bring your children? No, Swaminathan, they're not willing to come. My daughter's there, she's already ruined. One of these days she's going to get a disease, some STD she's going to pick up sooner or later. And then once that happens, well, we'll try and keep it as private as possible, but everyone's going to find out. And when that happens, she will come down, I'm sure, and then we will treat her. What else can we do? This is what the mothers, this is what the parents have decided to do. One of these days, the daughter's going to get an STD, and when she comes back to Sri Lanka, we'll look after and treat her. A parent has had to come to that conclusion. So we hope that it's nothing fatal, because if it's something fatal, what can we do? How can we tell society, how can we tell people around that she died of HIV? So we keep telling her, Buddha, please, you know, be safe, whatever you do. Because that's all we can tell her now. She won't listen to anything else. So what we do is, whenever we send her money, I also put in some, you know what, and send it. Just in case she forgets to buy one. Can you imagine a father who does that? When the father sends a package to the daughter, right, he puts in... That's the gift to the daughter. In case she forgets. Keep a few of these in your purse. A father? I asked him, have you not tried to at least get them to go to a temple there, wherever the daughter is? So she's in America. For what? For what? Education. Yes, education. Who's educated? Who's being educated? Parents. Parents. Daughter's gone for education, the parents are being educated. I'm not suggesting that education's a problem here. Don't get me wrong, we educate our children as well. I speak to you thanks to the education that I received in my life, thanks to my teachers. Education is not at fault here. It's the purpose behind it, lost. No Dhamma. Anything without the Dhamma is pointless. Food without the Dhamma? What do you think? Give a man food but no Dhamma. What are you going to get at the end of it? Obesity. Give the man food without Dhamma, you're going to get obesity out of it. Or cholesterol, or diabetes, or heartburns, this, that and the other. An early death. Give a man money without the Dhamma, what are you going to get? You're going to get a gambler, a womanizer, a hoarder. This is what you're going to get. Give a man a wife without the Dhamma. I really hope, you know, there are people here who still have young daughters, young sons, who have still, you know, yet to come off that age where you marry them off. I really hope, ladies and gentlemen, at least by this point you have realized that when you look for a suitable partner, a suitor for your son or your daughter, you at least ask them, Buddha, what is anicca? I mean, I tell you, if they don't have the answer to that, don't give your daughter. We'll do a bachelor's course here. How about that? We can organize something, a bachelor's course at the monastery. 1 month bachelor's course. To be married men and women can take a 1 month bachelor's course. At the end of that, if they're still ready, if they still want to get married, they can do. That's the catch. No, but you know, if you can listen to all this that I've just said, and you can still give your daughter and your son their hand in marriage to a person who you have no confidence at all, no knowledge at all about their understanding of Dhamma, or if you know that they have no interest in the Dhamma, I mean, I don't know what you're doing with your children. I don't think people have a right to just put their children's life into ruin like that. If you are not knowledgeable about these things, fair enough, but now you know. I don't think it's fair. You will see how wealthy they are, of good descent, yeah? Whether they're educated, but what about the most crucial part? Do they understand what it means to be human? Or do they just want what they can get out of your daughter? Her looks, her smell, her taste, her touch. Is that what you want to... Are you selling her, your daughter, really? Is that what you're doing? And the same goes to the son. If you want to give your son to a wife, to a woman, who has no understanding of the Dhamma, then beware. You might soon be on the receiving end of those slaps. I didn't tell you that part of the story, right? So I asked, what motivates this man to hit his mother? If he's going to be getting his fair share, what's the problem? Well, the Swami knows that that's the thing, the father says. Behind every successful man, you fill in the blanks. So this man has been very successful in hitting his mother, striking her, punching her, pulling her hair out. Very successful man. So behind this successful man must be a... I never said it. You said it, I didn't. So I said, why then? Why did you not check whether she was of the right kind of... She was right of good character before you? This? Well, Swami answered, there was never any time for that. She was good looking. And my son was... That was all he was interested in. I did tell him once or twice that, you know, Putta, you have to first check that you are getting married to the right kind of woman, because otherwise later on you will regret. But all he said was, you know, she's so beautiful, she's like a goddess, Tati. And find me a better looking woman and I will marry her. That's what the father, the mother, the son had said to the father. Find me a better looking woman and I would marry her. So she was young, she was very charismatic, attractive, and he wedded her. Grand wedding, as they do, nice hotel, fed the entire village, 15,000 a plate. It's not 15,000 anymore, right? That's a pack of backpacker. So at that time it was around 15,000. That's what he must have meant. Well, about a decade ago. 15,000 a plate, nice hotel. Married him off, and we sent him. At the beginning it was all good. She would come, visit us, But soon the visitation stopped. Even when the mother was sick, even when I needed help, there was no son. We would call him and initially he'd say, yes, I'll come, but these are all just promises, promises. Later on, she started answering the calls. So it came to a point where whenever we rang them, it was always the daughter who answered the phone. And whenever I wanted to talk to my son, he said, not available. And then soon we realized that she didn't want us to associate with him. But by that point it was too late. But then he started to ask us for money. Money for this, money for that. Then they started doing up their house and my bank account started to drain because it was my first son, my beloved son. So when he wanted something, what was the habit that they had gotten them into? Never say no. So whatever the children wanted, they'd always given. So now the father, almost nearing his retirement age, but no hope and dream of that, because now the child needed him to spend to feed his lifestyle with his new wife, and so that again the father had to find money for. Why? Natti mata, natti pita. So this child now, the wife had become everything. She was the most important person in his life now. No mother, no father. They're just ordinary human beings. Just, you know, average Joes. Whereas the wife, she's everything. But what he didn't realize was, she'd married him for his money. In exchange, she'd of course given a nice appearance. So, marriage life was good at the beginning, apparently, because, you know, all things are good at the beginning. Until later on, you start, you know, getting used to the same face. You know how beauty works. Absence is what makes a heart grow fonder, right? So, when you're always in the presence of whatever it is that you think is beautiful, after a while, what happens? The beauty becomes the beast. That's what happened. So that it has soon happened in the family, you know, 1 or 2 years into their marriage. Then it was just, the whole thing was a disaster. But her desires and needs were never satisfied. So they kept growing. So they wanted to travel the world. They wanted to go on trips and holidays and resorts. She had a very expensive taste in fashion and jewelry and such things. And when the husband couldn't provide, it still had to come from somewhere. So what did the girl do? Demand it. So there came a point where she still needed more money, but there was no money coming from the father, from the parents, but they had some, what? Land. So now it was time to sell off the land. See how everything pieced together nicely? So the parents got a good education, didn't they? I asked him, sir, are you considering a fourth? Then he says, I know why you're asking me this question. And I know that you don't mean in disrespect, but I have been thoroughly educated now, Swami Nansar. He says, I'm so disappointed that life had to teach me these lessons. Lessons I could have learned from you, he said. Towards the end of our conversation. That's what he said. Lessons I could have learned from you, Swami Nansar. I waited until life taught me them. But those ended up being very expensive lessons. I lost my youth. I lost my will to live. My wife has attempted suicide 3 times now, Swami Nansar. Fortunately, I was there just around the corner. And the last time it happened, I promised her, please don't do that to me, otherwise I would not be able to survive. You are the only hope I have now, left now. If you go, I will go. There's no point in me hanging around. What for? We've lost our children. We've lost everything. We might as well just give whatever we have and, you know, finish it off. So the only reason I'm here is because of you. And that's the day that my wife promised, I will not try that again. See? This is not just a script from a teledrama. This is real life. Where did they get it wrong? You tell me. Where did they get it wrong, ladies and gentlemen? This is the story I was sharing with those teachers. When they came back to me and said, but Swami, they don't end up in prison like that. Not everyone ends up in prison. I said, yeah, really? Listen to this story then. So they were already shocked when they heard this story. And I said, I haven't even said the best part of it yet to these teachers. Really? They asked me. I said, yes. Swamina, so what's the best part? That eldest son? What? Student at your school. They were speechless. I said, when you developed your curriculum, you didn't think about that, did you? Mata, pita. When you worked on extending your curriculum and bringing in all this, you know, international stuff and giving the highest, best education there is possible, you didn't think of mother, father in that equation, did you? You didn't consider that, did you? By this point, they had their heads in their hands. Teachers. The same question the father asked me, the teachers asked me. Swami Nasa, where did we get it wrong? Where did we go wrong? I did the same place the father went wrong. The same way that I was wrong for a long part of my life, but then I realized I was wrong. A life without Dhamma is not worth living. I'll put it to you in such simple terms, ladies and gentlemen. This is not embroidery. This is not boasting. This is as it is. A life without the Dhamma is not worth living. Because guess what? At the end of that life, you will hope that you'd never lived. Because what's coming after that is going to be hell. I said, if only you had brought that son when he was still receptive to what you had to say, when he was still obedient, when he was still young, if only you had taken him to the Dhamma school, if only you had introduced him to the Dhamma, one sutta, Singhalovada sutta, put Anicchidukkhanatta to a side. The advice that the Buddha gave to the young man Singhala and said, this is how you should fulfill your duties and obligations to your parents, to your teachers, to your friends, to your wife, to your husband, to your children. If only you'd introduced him to that. I said, because you had no time, right? You were too busy. Well, now you are very busy repenting. You barely have time for anything else now. I asked the father. You don't have time for anything else now. All you have time for is to repent, regret. That's what the two of you do now, don't you? At your leisure, you regret. Now you retired and Now we have, that is your job now, regret, full time. I really hope that this is not on the horizon for all of you. I really hope that what I have just related is not your future. Look at me in the eye. I'm speaking to you. I really hope that this is not your future. I don't want that for any of you, ladies and gentlemen. You are beloved fathers, you are beloved mothers. I know that. I know you are devoted. I know you would give your heart, you would give your soul, you would give your spirit to your children if that's going to do them good. But there's no point in giving any of that if you don't give them what they need. That is the Dhamma. Because it is only through the Dhamma I learned who the mother is and who the father is. Because science only taught me the biological relationship I had with them, not the spiritual connection. There's a very spiritual connection that we share with our mothers and our fathers that you won't find in the textbooks. So I said when I, just before the teachers departed, if you want, we are prepared to work together. If you want, you decide. Infuse the Dhamma into your children's lives. Don't just do a syllabus or a curriculum that gets them the best, the highest, the whatever in the world, that gives them recognition or puts them on a pedestal. Everyone will be awed by their performance, by their achievements. But if at the end of all that, what is left is the gates of the four great hells, you know, I would have to ask the same question, what is the point of teaching them? You tell me you wouldn't teach them if you knew that they were going to be in prison for the rest of their life as soon as they graduate from college. You tell me you won't teach them then. Well, I'm telling you, not about the end of this life, but they're going to go into the four great hells for eons. What's the point of teaching them then? Yes, they escape prison. Yeah. Because the parents never complained to the police, that child never ended up behind bars. Yeah. Because somehow he's found ways to keep the law enforcement at bay, he's still doing his drugs. But the second child, he's still not imprisoned. He's not behind bars. See how smart they are? Because they can cover up their tracks. Because they're educated. Educated. Learned. So they know how to cover up their tracks. They know how to make payments where there's no payment trail. Educated. That's how you have cryptocurrencies. So I asked the father, how do they get their drugs? Oh, Swami says, I don't know how we get. He says this is some place on the internet. So the father doesn't know. I said, yes, okay, I know what you're talking about. It's called the dark net. Hardly anyone knows of its existence, but those who know, know. It's where you can get whatever you want. You can get drugs, you can get weapons, you can have people killed. You can have, not just kill, you can place special orders as well. If you want their left ear, just make a special request. A few extra bitcoins, you can get their left ear. Or maybe and their nose, if you particularly dislike their nose, for instance. Just saying. Or if you want their head. So you can precisely, like, prescribe how you want that death to be inflicted upon them and what evidence you want in return post and where you want it delivered. Half the payment up front, the other half, once the job is done, if you don't pay the other half, then you are on the hit list. So everyone makes their payment on time. No one knows who does it, but the job gets done. You didn't know that such places existed, right? How they do. Both heaven and hell are on this earth. Just because you live in heaven, don't think that hell doesn't exist. It's next door. Just next door. Behind closed doors, behind drawn curtains, so many untold and can never be told stories take place. Events take place. They don't get published because they decide what gets published. They rule, they control. They wield unimaginable power. And you think democracy has given you the right, has given you power. Okay. Think so. Believe you me, ladies and gentlemen, this world does not run on democracy. It runs on ping and pow. Merit and sin. That's what this world runs on. If you want goodness to come to you, there is no other way other than to give goodness out. Even if you live in the lap of luxury, in some isolated tower somewhere, or live in palatial luxury, when your sins decide it's time to pay you a visit, all hell will break loose. One fine day you'll be living a good life. The very next day you could be tortured to death. Tortured to death. Maybe flayed alive. Put on a stake. Burnt. Electrocuted. Poisoned. Amputated. Right now you think, nah, not to me. Yes, not you now, that's it. Sansara is not a joke. It's real. Good and bad that you do, these are not jokes. They're real. When you do good, it's not a joke. It's really good. Really good. But the same goes for when you do bad. When your intentions are evil, you have to pay the price. People are not evil for the sake of evilness. People are evil when they can't control themselves. When their desires are limitless, that's when evilness begins to surface. When to please their eyes, they will do just about anything. When to satisfy their ears, they will do just about anything. When to satisfy their lust, they will do just about anything. They don't realize that this is a boomerang. It will come back when the time is right. So these websites, these forums, these things on the dark net, these are there simply to inflict such bad karma on people who have done it in the past. And by doing it, those who do, they accumulate even more. So whenever you treat someone badly, in other words, with bad intention, badness remains. You just exchanging from one pair of hands to the other. That's all. One person is the victim, the other person is the committer of the sin. And then, as soon as that the tables turn around, now that person, the committer becomes the victim, and then someone else becomes the committer. Badness always remains. Evil remains. It's like musical chairs. Today you're on one end of the desk, and the other time you're on the other end. You just swap places, that's all. That's why the only remedy to this is the Dhamma. Nahi verena verani. Sammanti the kudachana. Averena cha sammanti. Esa dhammo sanantano. But for that you have to go to the Dhamma school to learn that. You have to talk to a Kalyana Mitra. It's not in your psychology book, it's not in your biology book, it's not in your physics book, it's not in your math book, it's not for advanced math or calculus, for geometry, for algebra. They don't teach you this. University doesn't teach you this. Your PhD doesn't teach you this. So I related to you a very sad story of a mother and a father who, as a result of something they thought would bring them immense joy in the end, had to go through hell while they were still alive. Perhaps in this story you were able to relate to little bits of it. Maybe a syllable here, a syllable there. Perhaps you saw some references very close to maybe your own personal stories. Maybe some even crossed paths. The teachers were shocked when they realized that one of those children were actually an alumni of their own school. They were really shocked to hear that. I said, now the proof is in the pudding, isn't it? I said, you know, need I say more, or have I not just proven to you that education alone is not going to do this? I said, we realize now, Swami, no answer. We realize now. That's why I urge you, you know, among you will be teachers, educators, there will be doctors, engineers, lawyers, people who really want to do something good to this world. I know all of you want to do good to this world. My ask of you is this, this is for your intellectual thought, okay? My ask of you is this. You put in so much time, effort, energy to do good to this world. But I trust that you want that good to live, to last long. That good that you do, if you can get it to last long, if the people to whom you do good can go on to do even more good, wouldn't that be better than just doing good for the sake of it, and then soon after, they're just going to go into ruins? And perhaps even go and do destruction to the world. What would be the point of that? Can I ask you this question? Just hypothetically, right? If you were Hitler's physician, would you put your hand up and say, proudly, with pride and honor, that was me? I just take one name from history. Just one name. If you are Hitler's physician, would you put your hand up and say, Swami, that was me, I'm very proud to say that. Yes, I know, you treated a human being. That I get. That is a Hippocratic oath. Whenever we treat, we don't discriminate whether they are good or bad. We have no regard in that as doctors. That's why doctors are very honorable individuals. And that is true. But even if you've done that, in a room where I had to ask that question, I doubt it, that he would stand up and say, yes, I was Hitler's physician. Knowing the havoc that he went on to create in this world. I'm not saying that Hitler's a bad man. Just saying, badness took over him. One day he will see a Buddha. And one day he will become a Buddha. And soon may he do. That is always our wish. If Angulimala went on to become Angulimala, the great Arahant, well, what will Hitler go on to become one day? Hitler, the great Arahant. He may not be called Hitler on that day, some other name, but everyone has to go through that. Devadatta Thera. He tried to kill the Buddha. He tried to murder the Buddha and cause a schism in the Sangha. And also made one great king to go and torture and kill his father. I mean, in one lifetime, how can you pack so much sin is a question sometimes I ask myself. In one lifespan, how can you pack so much sin? So he'll be there, rotting away in hell for a very long time. But on one occasion, when people would scorn at him and mock him, the Buddha said, "No, you should not speak to him like that, because one day he is going to become a Paccheka Buddha. And you are only going to become Arahata Buddhas. He is going to become a Paccheka Buddha. So don't mock him. Don't look down upon him. Don't look at him with disdain. The action is what is bad, not the individual." The Buddha always sided with the sinners, because his purpose in life, he was there to save the sinners from the sin. That was the Buddha's role. That was Jesus Christ's role. He sided with the sinners. That's why he died on the cross. He died for the sinners, not for those who hadn't sinned. Right? The Buddha came into this world for the sinners, for people like you and I. We sin to save us from our sins. Not save us from the consequences of our sins, but from to save us from committing sins. Because once the sin is done, you cannot be saved. Either now or later, it will always come back. Unless you become someone who doesn't commit sin, at that point you have a get out of jail free card. You have an escape. That is the true victory of a sotapanna. Any sins you have done to be born in the four great hells, the moment you become a sotapanna, you are free from all that. Why? This is not because the Buddha's Dhamma has helped you escape from the sins you have committed, but because he has brought you to a point, the Dhamma has brought you to a point where you don't commit sins anymore. Therefore you get an escape. Do you see the distinction, ladies and gentlemen? I'll repeat that. The Buddha's Dhamma is not to help you free yourself from the consequences of your sins. That is only a bonus. But that is a gift. Please remember that. To be freed from the consequences of your sins is merely a gift for achieving what? A state of mind where you no longer desire to commit sins. That's the gift you get. So escape from the four great hells is a gift. That's the gift of a sotapanna. How beautiful that is. The greatest gift ever. But for that, the price you have to pay, or the commitment that you have to make, is that I shall never sin again. Certainly not with the intention to hurt. No desire to sin. So that's a worthy gift. Don't you think? It's a really worthy gift. If there was someone in this audience who promised that, you know, that's how they do it in the courts as well. If there's a man who commits a crime and they comes forward, right, and he says, right, I promise, from here on I shall never sin again. I shall never commit such offences again. Even the court is lenient to them. Isn't it? Even the courts are lenient. Are you sure you promise? You understand the gravity of your mistake, of your errors, of your sins, and do you promise solemnly that you shall not commit such crimes again? Yes, Your Honor, I promise. Okay, well then the sentence is, we are going to make it a little bit more lenient on you. In the same principle applies. The day that you commit yourself to never sin again, you are given a gift. What is that gift? Freedom from the consequences of your previous sins. Wow. There's only one way to get that. It is to make that commitment. Not just a verbal commitment. It has to be a spiritual commitment. An ironclad commitment, cast in stone, never to change again. That's an Aryakanta sila. That is the seal of a sotapanna. Not just precepts. This is not Panchasila, Atasila, Dasasila. This is Aryakanta sila. This is the sila, the virtuousness of a sotapanna. It comes through understanding the Dhamma. No other way. I don't have a precept to give you that you can observe and say, from here on we will conduct ourselves as sotapannas. You can't do that. There is no precept for that. You can take on a precept to say, I will conduct myself like a sotapanna, but not as a sotapanna. That comes through understanding, realization. That is arekanta sila. And the gift you get for that? Freedom from all sins you've committed that would take you otherwise to the four great hells. Free. Freed from that. Once and for all. Never again. Again, you see, give and get, right? Don't you see how the theory of give and get works there as well? You come into a contract with the universe. The contract that your part of the agreement is, I shall never commit sins. Certainly no heinous sins, absolutely none. But even if a sin is committed by, you know, the slightest chance, I shall never rejoice in that. I wouldn't do it out of desire. I wouldn't do it out of joy. It would only ever happen because I am left helpless and no other escape from that. And even if it were to happen, I would know wholeheartedly that it was wrong. Because it is only an arahant who doesn't sin at all. I'm talking about a sotapanna, three stages down. But if that's the commitment you make to the universe, then what you give to the universe gives back to you. The universe says back to you in exchange, fair enough. I can see that your commitment is solid because you have become a sotapanna. Well, then in exchange, all sins you have committed that would have otherwise brought you birth in the four great hells, you are exonerated. Where do you find the theory for that? Where do you find the path to achieve that? It's in the Dhamma, ladies and gentlemen, it's in the Dhamma. It's in the Dhamma. It's not in the textbooks. You will not find it at Oxford or at Cambridge or at MIT or any other university. It's only to be found in this really humble place called the Sasana. How much do you have to pay for that? Tuition fees? Term fees? Exam fees? Registration fees? How much? No, it's not none. It's merit. Don't think it's none. It's not none. That's a wrong answer. You can't put a dollar sign next to it. You have to pay for it with universal currency. Not Australian currency, American currency, sterling pound, British currency, Sri Lankan currency. No, you have to pay for it with universal currency. That is why you have to work hard to earn it, to pay for that. While you are in this sermon, you are paying. I am paying. I am earning. And so are you. This is one of those times where you spend and earn at the same time. Hopefully, by the time you leave this room, you will have earned more than you have spent. Then this becomes a good investment. Isn't that how you decide what a good investment is? If at the end of it you have earned more than you have spent? Yeah. That's why Swami Nasa gives you an opportunity to offer alms at the end of this as well, just in case you fell asleep in the sun. Because if you'd fallen asleep in the sermon in this very comfy environment, right? The air cons are working, keeping you nice and cool, the chairs are there, very soft and fluffy, or not fluffy, but what do you call it? Very comfortable, right? And you have a nice audience, a nice crowd looking after you. The washrooms are just next door. All these comforts right at, you know, at your doorstep. So for this you have to pay a price. This doesn't come for free. Never be fooled. This doesn't come for free. There's a price to pay. And that price is merits. But you can re-earn that if you remain alert throughout this talk and take in the Dhamma. Cleanse your drishti. Undefile your mind. If that happens during the course of this sermon, then you have earned a lot more than you have potentially spent. But then there are the odd Jones and the Janes. So none of you are John and Jane, right? So that's why. There's the odd John and Jane who doze off once in a while. So for them we have the arms round. Just in case. That's your insurance plan. Don't count on that. Fasten your seatbelt. But the reason I related that story to you is because I want you to understand the gravity of this. Today you can listen to that story. You're only shocked but not shaken. You might be shocked, but you're not in tears, because it's not your story, that's why. You may have heard similar stories. Maybe you are as unfortunate as I am to have heard such stories. And I hear these stories pretty much every other week. Far too many to remember. When I first heard my very first story as a monk, I was shocked. I said, what? This goes on out there? My gosh, I must help this man and quickly solve his problem. And once that problem is solved, I thought that's it, no one else has such problems. 2 days later, another man comes. And then I quickly solved his problem and I thought, oh, surely those were the only two individuals in this world who had such problems, so those problems have now been solved. And I went to bed happy, knowing, or at least thinking to myself, that I had solved all of the world's problems. But I woke up the following morning and had another appointment. And a similar problem. At some point I realized, there's no end to this. People are just wearing masks. When you see them at the party, in the parties, they've got their masks on. At the birthday party, as they blow their candles out, they've got their masks on. Don't ever think that when a person smiles at you, they're as happy as the smile might tell you. No, it's just a smile. Smile doesn't mean happiness. That is something I learned very soon into my ordination. A smile does not equate happiness. It's what we have to do. Smile. So whenever you walk into a store and the shopkeeper or the attendant or the security officer, they smile at you, don't think that they're happy to see you. They're happy seeing you, looking at your pockets. Potentially that's what they're happy to see. Dollar signs they see as you're walking through the door, or rupee signs, whatever. I'm not suggesting that everyone is just money-minded, but what I'm saying is everyone is selfish. Otherwise you would not be born. If you're not selfish, you won't be born. Simple as that. I was born because I was selfish. If I wish not to be born again, what must I become first? Non-selfish, selfless, selfless. Not less of a self, entirely selfless. That is the only way to not be born. So if anyone's born, look around you whether there are any people who are born. So if you see anyone who was born, simple as that, right? Whether they are man or woman, human or beast, doesn't matter, then that is a sure and short sign that they were selfish, at least at some point. There's only one bridge that gets you from selfishness to selflessness. What is that bridge called? Indeed. Thank you, sir. It's the Dhamma. The Dhamma is the only bridge. If you keep avoiding that bridge, you can keep going round and round and round in circles, but you will always be in the land of selfishness. There's no other path out of this land. There's only one bridge that gets you from selfish land to selfless land. The Bible will say this is earth and that is heaven. The Tripitaka will say this is the 31 realms of existence and on the other side is Nibbana. Existence and non-existence. To exist, you must be selfish. You cannot exist if you are not selfish. Because what exists after all? Selfishness is what exists. What doesn't exist? Well, you can't say what doesn't exist because it doesn't exist. But whatever exists is selfishness. So what you heard in that story was 3 + 2 cases of selfishness. So in the end, when towards the end of that conversation with the parents, I said, "Sir, madam, permit me to call you that because despite all that has happened, you tried with your best of intentions. You are good parents. Well, I can't say you're good parents. I said, you are good human beings. You have failed as parents. There's no doubt about that. You have failed as parents. I don't need to rub that in your face because you know that that is true. You have failed as parents, but you are still good human beings. You know, you never hit your child. Because to hit anyone is bad. It's the same. Doesn't matter whether it's your friend or your foe. If you hit with anger, that's bad. Right? So, but you've been good in that way. And you told me that you'd never spoken to your wife in a bad way. You've always been kind to her, loving to her, used very soft words, never admonished her. So that's a good sign. And this is a mother, a helpless mother. She gave her whole self up, her physical form, her psychological happiness, all she gave away for her children. So in some ways she has selflessness about her. So if you like, I will teach the Dhamma to you. It's too late for me to help your children. But if you are willing to, I can wipe those tears off your face. And they got down on their knees and they said, "Swaminarayan, well, if that's all we can do now, please accept us as disciples." And that's how that story came to an end. But the sinners are still out there, sinning. The children are still out there. I don't know whatever happened to them after that. The parents severed their connections because it was time for them to move on. They realized no point in going after them. I mean, I reminded the mother, in case your daughter, because there will come a point where your daughter is going to be helpless. Like right now she's just being used and abused and just used as like a piece of meat. That's what your daughter is. She's just flesh. Yes? She's just flesh, being passed from one dog to the next. Just a piece of flesh around a bone. So, at one point, she's going to get eaten up and then she's going to get discarded. She's just going to be the bone without the flesh. And at that point, she will come back looking for mercy. When she does, accept her. And if she's prepared to bring her, I will try and fix her. Fix her up. But right now, she doesn't want that. Because what she wants is lust, sensuality, enjoyment, pleasure. She wants to satisfy herself. She thinks she's living the good life. She doesn't have to settle for one man. She can get it in various different ways from various different men. Freedom, isn't it? Freedom. See, that's what freedom's come to. Freedom. Liberty. Freedom of choice. That's why our motto is not the freedom of choice, but the choice of freedom. These children are looking for the freedom of choice, to make the choices that they want to make, without censure, without restriction. That's why I urge all of you adults, I'm in a room full of very educated people, I have the privilege of speaking to you. You are people who can shape the future of this world, of our nation, of our people, of our children. You have the power to do that, ladies and gentlemen. If no one else, you have the power to change the way that you work, you act, you think. And then your siblings, your children, your offspring, your parents, your families. But for many of you, you have the power to influence much larger populations than that. Choose wisely. Don't always do what is popular or what's easy. Do the right thing. Sometimes doing what is right is difficult. Therefore, people tend to go with what is popular because it brings them short-term fame, short-term glory, short-term recognition. Other times people do what is easy because it just gets the job done and they can move on to the next thing. But just because something's popular, something's easy, doesn't mean that's the right thing to do. Because whatever action you take, you are accountable. Personally, individually, you are accountable. You can get together as a group and do things, but when the consequences come back to you, or the rewards come back to you, they're not served as a group. They're served individually. So you can do group business, but the profits and the losses have to be borne individually in this enterprise. Therefore, please think wisely. Don't necessarily be influenced by your peers or your seniors or your subordinates, your colleagues, your parents. Treat them well, but I'm not suggesting that you must always be influenced. Always be influenced, no. Only do the right thing that they ask you to do, not everything. Don't even take me for granted like that. Don't think that everything I say has to be the truth. No. That's why it is imperative that I speak to an intelligent audience. There's no point in speaking to fools, because a fool cannot do anything even if I gave you what is golden. Therefore, there's no point in me speaking to a foolish audience. I speak to an intelligent audience because that is imperative. It's really important. Because that's when you can do something with what I give you, and therefore, there's also an added responsibility that lay on your shoulders, which is, don't just take what I say for granted. Don't just take it as gospel truth. Use your intelligence, the same intelligence that is required for me to, or for you to do whatever you have to do with what I give you. Do try and do what is right. Start at your home. Start with your children. Start with yourself. I mean, you have all been entrusted with one person, right? To do good with. Hasn't God entrusted each and every one of you with one person to do good with? Who's that? Who? You, of course. See how much God trusts you? If there's a God, see how much God trusts you? He has entrusted you with one whole life, 120 years. He has entrusted you with 120 years of life and said, do what is right by this life. Therefore, you are given conscience. You are given conscience, a good conscience, a guilt-free conscience. Live by that. Even if you have no dhamma at all, a guilt-free conscience is usually a very good indicator of whether what you're doing is righteous or not. It's always a good measure. 9 times out of 10 it's a good measure. But you have more than that, you have the Dhamma, you have Kalyana Mitras, you have noble friends, you have this community, you have the Dhamma. There are the Rahatan Mahanses who still live amongst us. There are people who have seen the truth, who live amongst us, who freely share it with all of us. Make use of it. Better your lives every day. Never compete with another man. Compete with yourself. Ensure that yourself tomorrow is a better self than yourself today. Until a point comes where you're no self at all. Because the best self to be is selfless. Until then, become a better self than the previous self. So become better tomorrow than you are today. One small step at a time, that's enough. Don't ever take giant leaps, that's not necessary. Slow and steady. See, this is what the Dhamma is for. All of this is today to remind you what the Dhamma is for. See, last week we talked, there was some heavy Dhamma. It was quite deep, there's a lot of depth in it, very profound. Some of you didn't even know which way to look. Some were looking up at the sky wondering what's going on. Some of you looking like this from about 10 minutes into the talk. Already given up. So I realized, you know, last week was quite deep. Fair enough, I mean, this is how we do it, right? It's not a plain fabric. In and amongst this fabric you see little bits of embroidered jewels and, you know, gems. It's all there in this fabric that we call gateway to Nibbana. So not every sermon is heavy. It's by design. That's how it's meant to be. If every sermon was heavy, then half of this room would leave and the other half would fall asleep. The other half will remain because they have a sandwich at the end of the day. I would be the only one who would be thanking you all for your presence while listening to the sermon. That's why it is by intent and by design that not all sermons are deep. Now, is there any part of today's sermon that any of you didn't understand? You understand all of it, right? You understood all of it. So would it be right to say those sermons in Rajagiri, oh, can't understand anything. Half of it this way, the other half above that. So are these Greek sermons? No. So interspersed between these soft sermons, you have some heavy sermons. But this is to remind you why Dhamma, why? Like I said, it's just as important as what Dhamma. The why Dhamma is just as important. Because this will bring you back the following week. This will bring you back the following week. This will be interesting to many new starters, newcomers. They'll hear, my gosh, if this would ever happen to me, I don't know how I would face such a situation. So if Dhamma is the only refuge, then I need to get it before it strikes me. Before my bad luck strikes me, I have to get the refuge of the Dhamma. So perhaps this is the sermon that might interest two other people to come in from the following week. But if you got people to listen to last week's sermon, then no one would come. Only the regulars. As just before, while we were waiting in the chairman's office, Anagariki Mahatya came and asked me, Swami, what props do you need for today's sermon? I said, I don't know what I'm going to talk about, so let's see. Keep them at the back. When I need them, I will give you a call. Because the previous Anagariki Mahatya now is the Pandu Mahatya. So you see that he's no longer coming to Rajagiri. Now he's getting ready for his ordination. Where did he earn the merits for that? course. Doing what he does, doing this, doing that, doing the other, doing everything for the sasana. Learning his colors. These are the colors. So we have colors night. Usually it's only once a year, but at our monastery, about 3 or 4 times a year, we have colors night. Saffron is the color to be worn on the day. I have a video to show you. This video is about pink ether. The pink ether that you all cultivated when you visited the monastery the last time you did. The sasana is a field of merit, ladies and gentlemen. It truly is. It's where you earn your currency to understand the depths of what the Buddha taught. Those parents, you know, they fell into a spell of really bad luck. One might call it bad luck, but in my language, there is no such thing called bad luck. It's sins. The sins that they had committed were now coming back to them through their own flesh and blood. There's no such thing called bad luck. Their own sins were coming back to them through their own flesh and blood. Sometimes it comes to you from your parents. Sometimes it comes to you from your children, through your children, sometimes through your siblings. Sometimes a stroke of lightning. Who knows? Sometimes the cat. Sometimes a stray dog. Sometimes a vehicle as you cross the street. So your sins can come at any point. But likewise, your merits can also come to you at any point, particularly so when you are amongst noble association. Indeed. That is what you are doing right now. See, if you had come here alone, you may not have heard this sermon. Actually, that is very true. You don't meet me alone, do you? I mean, you know, we have very short conversations, but have I ever given any of you a 3-hour, 4-hour long sermon? Have I? No. And you won't get it either. Because that's not how it works. But you see, when you team up, when you bring with you a noble community, then Swaminarayan's mouth opens. Then he doesn't even have to come prepared. He sits down, opens, and he starts speaking. Just because the good lady on this side hears this sermon, do you, the lady on that side, hear any less of the sermon? Is that how it works? So is the sermon kind of like split among 200-300 of you? Is that how it works? No, you all get the same sermon, right? But if you came alone, would you get it? No, then you wouldn't. See, this is what I mean. This is the power of community. You come together and you all walk away with a full sermon. Come alone, you get no sermon. Do you understand that this is not just Swaminarayan who does this? This is why the Sangha community is instrumental to this journey, ladies and gentlemen. Even if I walked up to Guru Handro, you know, he might answer one or two of my questions. And he says, okay, I'll answer that question and in the Mahadeshana. See, I have to wait until the Mahadeshana. When everyone comes together. Because he says, you know, that's a very good question. And I think everyone deserves to hear the answer to that. So I say, oh, sadhu, sadhu, Guru Handro, you know, then we are, of course, we are all very fortunate to listen to what you have to say on that matter. I shall wait till Thursday, or I shall wait till Saturday. But what's really going on is under the covers is everyone has to come together and put their, you know, into this collection of merits, into this pot of merits, which then goes onto the starts to brew, and out of that you get the Dhamma. So that is the beauty of this community. foster it, nurture it, nourish it. And long may it guide you. Long may it keep you on the noble path. Get support from each other, but don't depend on them. So if there's one amongst you who feels that you are ready to jump, jump. Don't say, let's all hold hands and jump. If you all start to hold hands before you jump, no one's going to jump. Jump when you feel you're ready. Because there are others who have jumped before you, so don't you worry. Jump and we will catch. Don't worry. If you were the first to jump, then perhaps. See, he was the first to jump. There was no one to catch him. But ever since he jumped, there was always someone there to catch. For the next 2,500 years, there will always be someone to catch. After that, there will be none. So once that time has passed, jump with caution. But right now, jump with confidence. You understand what I mean? Do you? Good. Let's watch the video. Did you read that last line? May that phrase always resonate in your hearts and minds till the end of time. Long live the Sri Sambuddhasasana. It is the only oasis. It is the only place of solace. It is the only place you can find peace. We are what makes the sasana the sasana, ladies and gentlemen. Take out the people, take out the bhikkhus, the bhikkhunis, the upasakas and the upasikas, what's left? The pagodas, the shrines, the statues, the historical artifacts, that's not the sasana. Your heart is where the sasana lives. This is the eternal flame of the sasana is in your heart. The desire to be free of desire. You heard me right. The desire to be free of desire. That is what the sasana is. That lives in your heart. So long live the Sri Sambuddhasasana. Therefore, long live the desire to be free of desire. So for as long as the freedom from desire is the desire that you have, the sasana prevails. A day shall come where there will no longer be a desire to be free of desire. That day there shall only remain desire. That is the day that the sasana will have perished. It's a nightmare. But that nightmare is also slowly coming our way. But until such time, we all have a fighting chance. Thanks to the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. I asked you a question before we organized this event. I'll ask that question again. I asked you before this event was organized, how many of you had sewn or washed a robe? Those that put their hands up that day, can you put your hand up again? That day. Not after this event, before this event. Good. Very few. What about now? Sewn, washed, a robe. Many more. Many of you. If you did it with love, with the purest of intentions, and the freedom to be free, or the desire to be free of desire, because that is what the robe represents. This is not just mere piece of cloth. This is what they call the flag of the Arahants. This symbolizes the freedom from desire. So if you did it with that intention, then whatever intention you release into the world, that comes back to you. So all those meritorious deeds that you engaged in that day, it was such a joy to see how engaged you were in all those activities. And this is not just my comment. Many monks and anagarikas, they came and shared their comments about their experience of the day. And they said, there's something very special about these Rajagiriyas, like Andhra. They came and told me that. I said, what is it? I said, I don't know. That's what they said. We don't know what it is, but there's something very special. It's like, you know, they said, we have spoken to people from the city before, but never have they been like this. It's like they come from the city, but in their heart they're very Ingirian. Although their residence is Rajagirian. That's how they put it into words. So I think they see a connection with you. It's as if we are all come here for the same purpose. And that is true. So one of our Anagarikas had given a letter to her sister, who is in the audience still. Don't know what she's doing in the audience, but that's another matter for another day. And she walked up to me and said, Swaminathan, sir, this I think is a letter of affection and love which everyone must hear. And she asked me whether I would like to read it to you all. So here goes nothing. Dear mothers, fathers, brothers and sisters, we were truly overjoyed to have you home with us a couple of weeks ago, and the time we shared together meant so much to us. We hope your time with us was both meaningful and fulfilling as you took part in the many meritorious deeds lovingly arranged for you in honor, remember this, in honor of offering your first 5 children to the Sri Sambuddha Sasana. So there was a price to pay for that, okay? We look forward to welcoming 5 more of your children very soon and to gently holding Nayaka Thero to his promise of organizing another day of blessings, merits and togetherness for all of us. Because we agreed on an exchange rate on that day. 5 from you, 1 from me. Mm-hmm. So, I hope the soup is cooking. Please accept this as a heartfelt note of gratitude from all of us. And I have you heard half of this on the day, here's the other half. It all started on a fine Sunday morning, dressed in white, and there was a gathering. Not a theme party, neither a fine dining. A lot more to come, this was just the beginning. A scientist in a robe talked happyology. It was more interesting than psychology, chemistry and physics and a lot of biology. We are all nature and that's ecology. Quite the poet, isn't she? Came for the sermon, stayed for the community. Neither for the sandwich nor for the cup of tea. Rajagiriyans, I think what she says is nor for the cup of tea Rajagiriyans. I broke it at the wrong place. Right, now I get it, okay. Neither for the sandwich nor for the cup of tea. Rajagiriyans, Dharmishta, they are called proudly. Nothing would stop them, not even a calamity. Week by week, more friends came following. What's this all about? They were inquiring. It's the power of merits, everyone's speaking. So glad to be here, they gave in writing. From the first sermon to the 50, we had gathered more than plenty. Then came the senti, which showed us our unity. Remember the days we offered flowers that bloom? We laid pavada and offered alms in noon. Now we are on the other side of the spoon. We are waiting for you to come home soon. There we go. That's a call home to all of you. You know, what I really admire about them is this, their sense of gratitude. That's truly admirable. You know, they found their escape. They found their solace. They found freedom. But they haven't forgotten their roots. I didn't ask for them to write this. This was not prompted. This is to help you feel that they truly care. To remind you that there's love, plenty of it, at another home than just yours. This is a call home. Ask you to come back where you belong, where it all started, so that it can all end. You started from nothingness. Today you are something. You will go back to nothingness again. It's just a matter of time. The sooner you do it, the less you will suffer. The longer it takes, the more you shall weep, the more you shall cry. That is why this is a beckoning. It says, come home soon. Let's put an end to suffering. They're already on the path. A lot of people got together to put that video together. A lot of people got together to put the event together. Because there were a lot of decisions to be made, a lot of organizing to be done, the transport to be arranged. I'm talking about the stuff that you don't know happened, because you know what you had to do to get together, to organize all that. But there was also a lot of work that happened behind the scenes at the monastery, at Metsevan, at the rehabilitation center, at the Noble Hearts premises, at the school. A lot of work went into making all that happen. In the kitchens, there were people who were in there before you, and they finished as soon as they could possibly do what they had to do to vacate the prison, to vacate the kitchen, so that you could come in there and do what you were there to do. The sewing rooms, where the Anagarikama asked me to sew our robes. I always wear these robes with a lot of love and always a prayer of gratitude to all those young hands and very devoted hands that sew these robes. It's not just the devotees who offer this fabric, this cloth to us, but the Anagarika Mahatmyas who very lovingly and with such respect and devotion. You must have seen it on the day. It was certainly visible in your faces as you chanted a prayer while you sewed the robe. It's infectious, isn't it? This love, this affection, this devotion is really literally infectious. That is what the community represents, ladies and gentlemen. And what is it that has made us who we are today? That is the Dhamma. And a very unique teacher, very special in ways that words can't describe, who made infinite wisdom, boiled it down to a spoonful and said, open. And we went, ah. And he put the spoon into my mouth and said, now, swallow it. And I felt better. Then I thought to myself, why not? Why just me? Why not others? See, we are very fortunate to be in the presence of people like that. To have Guru Andhra there, just like a rock It is a rock. It is a fortress. It is such a pillar of strength and much more than I have the words to describe. I can imagine if Guru Handra is like this, what about his teacher and the teachers before him and the greatest teacher of all? I always say, through Guru Handra I see Budhu Handra. So if Guru Handra is like this, just imagine what Budhu Handra must have been like. Isn't it? Just imagine what Sariputta Thera must have been like. The Buddha says he is like a mother. In the Buddha's words, this is the Buddha says, the Sariputta Thera is like a mother in the sasana. Just imagine how motherly he must have been, despite being an arahant. Doesn't weep like a mother, doesn't cry like a mother, is not selfish like a mother. Selflessly motherly. These are our ancestors. But let's not just keep them and have them as stories of our ancestors. Let's become them. Let's bring back Sariputta Thera. Let's invite Mahamoggallana Thera. Let's invite Kasyapa Thera. Let's invite the Rahula Maharathan Vahanse. Let's invite Bhadrakachayana, the great Thera. Let's invite Kisa Gautami. Let's invite them. Let's ask them to come back. How? Through you. Because for as long as the Dhamma is here, it's all possible. This is how you make a start. So I truly hope you rejoice, not only on the day, but also in the thoughts and the memories of the day. And no sooner than you give me another 5, I will arrange another one, I promise. I think there's a few already on the cooker. I know there are 2 or 3 cooking. One is already there, the little one. I think you saw him on the day. He's already there. So 1 down, 4 to go. Earn it. Earn. Earn what you deserve. Earn what is rightfully yours. And let's make Nibbana happen again. Let's call it a day. Let us all take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired today by inviting the Swami Nuhansa to deliver the sermon, listening to the Dhamma, contemplating the Dhamma, as well as making offerings to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. First and foremost, let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us transfer its merits to the Mahanayakas, the Anunayakas of all of the chapters throughout the world who have sacrificed their lives to protect and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to those who practice the path and the noble livelihood throughout the world, whether it be their bhikkhus or bhikkhunis, upasakas or upasikas. Let us also transfer these merits to my teacher Guru Swami Mahanse, as well as all of the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also transfer these merits to our devotees, friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as pass on your know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, as well as anyone and everyone who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us transfer these merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer this message to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer this message to our forefathers, our ancestors, those who passed away in our name, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life as we do. Let us also transfer this message to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. Let us also transfer this message to those who lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been parents to us, siblings to us, friends to us and teachers to us, and helped and supported us in many ways and forms, unimaginable and unfathomable. Therefore, with an abundance of compassion, loving kindness and a sense of gratitude for all that they have done for us, let us transfer these merits to all of them. May, by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plane, they be redeemed from the woeful plane and be born in the blissful plane. May all beings in the blissful planes be able to rejoice in these merits, be free from any obstacles to their salvation, contemplate the Dhamma and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits that we have all acquired today, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of Arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who has helped make this program a success become a Rahatan Mahanse or an Arahat Theranin Mahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Sri Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga kinnin mitatmva Dvesha kinnin mitatmva Moha kinnin mitatmva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetmva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetmva Mamadasya duloka siyadu satmvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetmva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetmva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetmva Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivansata labeva Nivansata labeva Nivan sapalaveva Tunurvange suvisi ananta maha guna belen Silu loka silu satyom Nibbana parama sukhen sukhita taravetva Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.